You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
What is up, Launch Street? I think today's interview is going to surprise you a little bit. I interview Kathy Chang, who is the author of a book that's all about monetizing data. Now, you might be asking, what do innovation and data have to do with each other? Which is exactly why I wanted to have her on, because I think that there's a myth out there that data and innovation are mutually exclusive. In fact, that they're complete opposites of each other. But what I've discovered in my 20 plus years of work is that the opposite is actually true. Data can actually set you free to be innovative if you're looking at the right data and the right metrics and putting them into a framework, not just looking at the flood of data, because God knows we have access to a million things out there and data points, but looking at the right data can actually help innovation. So Kathy and Andrew Roman-Wells wrote a book together, which is called Monetizing Your Data, A Guide to Turning Data into Profit-Driving Strategies and Solution. And with the explosion of information available from emails, online searches, text messages, blog posts, and posting on Facebook and YouTube, Wells and Chang have seen a shift in how data is being used across all business sectors and have unique insights and knowledge into the analytics that business leaders should be using to increase their profit. So combined together, they have 25 years in business intelligence and data management and analytics, which is why I wanted to have them on. So we were fortunate enough to have Kathy William Chang with us. She's also the VP of Business Insights at Wunderman Data Management, as well as the author of this book. So I think you're going to like this one. It's a little bit mind-blowing given the topic we're talking about. So enjoy. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us on Inside Launch Street today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to start actually by digging into your bio, because something really stood out to me, and then we can talk about the book and so many other things when it comes to data and innovation. But one of the things that you said that really resonated with me was that you were frustrated by the inability to trace issues to their root cause. Will you talk a little bit about kind of what you meant by that and how that got you to where you are today?
Sure. So early in my career, I started off in analytics, financial, and then marketing and strategic analytics. And just due to the limitations of the systems in terms of the capacity of the data that it could process, the speed that it could process, the cost to process data, we typically access it through business reporting type systems and Excel spreadsheets. And in order to gain the efficiency and get the information to business analysts such as myself, it would be a lot of aggregation and averaging going on. So you would have you'd have good information about your customers or your product, but it would be here's your performance by month and with different averages, or here's your performance by a product line, or here's your performance by a business unit, and you see different things that were not going in the correct manner, and you try to drill down and say, well, is this a product issue, a customer issue, a market? And because they weren't interconnected and the underlying structure had been disconnected through the averaging and aggregating, then you could no longer really determine what was the true cause. And so it was always very frustrating because you're trying to answer these questions, and you can make guesses about what you think is driving performance, but it's only a guess, and there's no real way of truly verifying and understanding those underlying systems.
What I think I really appreciate too about what you're saying, and I'm just kind of smiling as you're talking, is that I think then what happens is, and I'm sure you see this all the time, you know, we as the team trying to figure something out, solve a problem, improve performance, or, you know, make smart decisions are focusing on the wrong things. It takes us down a whole rabbit hole that isn't actually the right rabbit hole.
Exactly, and that's an important big part of our book that we dedicate to is more the soft side of the analytics, which we've put under the context of decision analysis and decision theory. We talk a good bit about biases, and that's where once you have a certain metric, two people can look at the same metric and say, oh, well, I think it's because of this, and I think it's because of that, and a lot of that is driven by the biases that they may actually bring. Be aware of, whether it's a confirmation bias or an anchoring bias. So unless you can get into the underlying data and really present and analyze the information objectively with the facts of the behavior, you really, you don't know who is right. And so, as you said, you end up going after wrong causes and sometimes doing more harm than good.
Yeah, it's so true. And you really do. You end up wasting a lot of time and potentially come up with solutions that don't ultimately help. I mean, they don't solve it. And you find that out, but after you've, you know, implemented the solution. So Andrew is your co-author. Talk to me a little bit about how you two came together and why you wrote the book, The Monetizing Your Data, Profit Driving Strategies. I'd love to know kind of how that all came together before we dig into the depth of it, so we can get to the, you know, a little bit of the why behind your passion for this.
So Andrew and I worked together a couple of years ago in the consulting company Aspirant, which Andrew heads that company. I was worked on some projects with him. So we worked together for a couple of years on some pretty large and extensive projects. We both came at the business from different perspectives. Andrew is very analytical and quantitative, but he comes at it more from a management consulting background and more a little bit on the qualitative side of trying to understand business issues and strategic and planning, whereas I had come at it more from being inside large organizations, phone companies primarily, but also manufacturing, and really working at it from the data side or the business data side up, so much more heavily quantitative and analytic. When we worked together on one project, which was involved data visualization, which is very new in this world now, you know, in the recent times, and it's certainly one that I've, as you mentioned about passion, I've really just has lit my fire, because it's allowed me to do things that I wanted to do so badly in the earlier times, and just the technology wasn't there. So working on these projects that were enterprise level, in essence, a data presentation of very complex data, but having presented visually. We just saw how these two have to come together if you're really going to be effective. And as we were working on it, we said, we really had to share this. I mean, we both felt like it was a defining point in our career. We both have a good 20, 30 years in the business. And we felt like it just brought together all the different aspects of different issues we worked on, struggles we've had, and challenges, and that we felt like they really started to come together. So we decided, let's collaborate on a book, and that's how we got here.
That's really cool. And I love that you guys have kind of the opposite sides of the coin, for lack of a better way to say it. To me, it seems like, you know, the data is a wonderful thing for innovation in many ways. It tells you really important things on one hand. On the other hand, it can also trap you and hold you back and keep you in this, I think you alluded to it earlier, this incredible analysis phase that never ends. So how do you see those two linking together? How do you leverage data to push smart innovation forward and not get trapped in that analysis, too much data, you know, making guesses about what it means phase?
This is actually, when you mentioned that bringing innovation and data, it's not usually the two are not normally married, but I think there's an incredibly tight connection. When I first started working, again, as I mentioned, studying businesses from a systems modeling, systems analysis side, one of the major seminal sources was called a book called In 1962 by Everett Rogers, The Diffusion of Innovations. And he introduced the theory of how and why, the rate at which new ages and technology spread. He introduced the technology adoption curve.
I have that book on my desk. That's so funny.
It is a Bible.
It's great. Yeah, it is about adoption cycles
Right. And this whole idea of the adoption cycle and the S curve, because I kept seeing that show in all my analytics. You kept seeing the peak, the slow takeoff, the fast, and the peak, and then when we looked at our business growth. And I realized this really is capturing the essence of how business works. And then in 1991, Geoffrey Moore, which you may have that one too, Crossing the Chasm, popularized that same fundamental concept in the marketing and innovation technology. And that's, of course, where we've got the commonly known innovators or adopters, majority, laggards. You know, it became mainstream at that point. All of that, that whole idea of innovation and how it diffuses is very system data driven. It's the interconnection of how these different data points work together. And so if you want to, you know, as an innovation, looking at it from an innovation perspective, launching a new product or feature or service, you have to plan for that curve. You have to plan where you are on it and don't fall in the chasm. And that's where data becomes key to monitoring, where am I, how am I tracking, where is it catching hold, where is it not, and getting into spotting trends early and seeing where they are as they drive through that. That's having ability to see how the data is traveling really helps you manage that curve. Another aspect is, again, another idea that came out in the 90s of the concept of one-to-one marketing. You may remember that one as well.
Yeah.
And it was a kind that was way ahead. It was an idea that was way ahead of its time at the time, because today you could think, well, we can understand people and their preferences, and we have this internet technology, but we really didn't have enough ability to collect the information around individuals and retain it, because again, we were still in reporting in those days. But now with data, that's changed. You can now actually model individuals. You can have real-time responsive websites that can, based on some understanding of your behavior and your audience group, they can really respond to you and what you want and not just give you a whole bunch of irrelevant content, say when you're looking at different web properties. So the ability to now track and get under the hood, so to speak, of how products and are working, how your product is working in the market with your customers and tying those points together is just opening up a real richness of being able to manage and drive innovation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I would add to that, and I'd love to get your perspective, that there's a great opportunity on the front end to look at the data that you have. And it could be as simple as, how engaged are your customers on your website, meaning how long do they stay, to your customer purchases, to whatever those kind of key metrics are to you. And I want to talk a little bit about how you figure that out in a second. But using that as your base point for innovation, because we really do need to start with where we are to get to where we're going. And, we kind of forget that sometimes. We go so far out with innovation that we forget that, hey, let's marry this with where we are so that we can do something meaningful. But we tend to, sometimes we tend to lose sight of that. Like, hey, we should look at where we are. In fact, it opens up more innovation. So, and kind of backing up into what I was just saying, how do you determine which metrics are they always, are they like key performance indicator metrics where it tells you what's going to happen next, more of an action metric? Is it a lagging metric? What do you find is the best thing to look at if I'm, leading a team and I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to dig into my data because it helps?
Just picking up on what you were mentioning about, where we are let's look at the information we have available to us. And that does, again, tie back into the important aspect of what we present in the book, of the focus on and consciousness of decision theory and in terms of, again, biases. Because a lot of times when we look at information and we look at information presented to us, we see it through a lens of what we want.
Yeah, right.
Where we would like to be. And then we try to make the data fit, the story that we have in our minds. So as you mentioned, it's really important to have the discipline to look at the information and data and say, okay, well, I think this is just the coolest product I ever had, but people aren't clicking on it, or people aren't investigating, or people aren't searching on it. So that you have to then take that cold water and figure out is it some tweak, or is it something more substantive that's blocking that that idea or that product from becoming successful. So the metrics are, it's interesting because it is once you get to, again, with this very raw, granular data, you can create umpteen thousand metrics, and many people, I have been parties to, and guilty of creating many, many, hundreds of metrics. And it's also tempting to try to look for that single bullet that's just going to, this will tell me the answer, some incredible algorithm, or that way I can just run this and look at this report and it's going to tell me what to do, and then I'm going to be humongously successful. It's important to realize you can't analyze unknowns away. They're unknown unknowns and known unknowns, what data lets you do is it lets you narrow the scope of your unknowns, but fundamentally, you can't get rid of them. I always like to say that you can't analyze away risk of making decisions and making taking future-oriented decisions. So even like predictive modeling, which has its place, is very useful. But a prediction, as I always like to say, is by definition false because it's a prediction. And so one of the things that frustrates me to no end is that you'll try to predict finance or a budget or something, and then they'll measure you for forecast accuracy, and you know, anything short of 100%, you have to explain.
Right, it's a failure,
a forecast is by definition not going to be correct, and so you have... And so when you get into it, it's actually simpler is better. It's, sometimes these metrics are just as simple as how many clicks or click-through rates or very standard ones. It's more important is not so much having really sexy metrics or metrics that are going to tell you, all I have to do is just get up and make money today. It's a simpler, and obviously in many cases is better. Going back to Occam's razor and just make things as simple as possible. And so in order to know how to simplify and how to figure out those precious few, it's very important to know, again, it gets back to, well, what is your purpose? What action are you trying to drive? And in order to decide on an action, what answers do you need to know? So what questions? And then you can then start really saying, well, I only really need to know about clicks. I only need to know my click-through rate and this for this one, because anything else is, if it's referrals or something, really doesn't matter for what I'm trying to do. So that's one way of trying to make sense of it and make it manageable.
You know, there's two things for the people out there listening in Launch Street that I want to pause on. I think that what Kathy's saying is so important. One is, and we talked even more in depth in the beginning of this interview, which is start with the end in mind. Start with what you're trying to figure out and then work backwards to what questions you need to answer. I think you're so right that we tend to start with the questions. We look at the data and say, I wonder why is this blah, 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 as opposed to having a lighthouse of what we're trying to accomplish. So I love that. The other thing that I just want to pause on for a second is the statement you made, which I think is so true, which is you can't analyze away risk.
Right.
And I love that because I see that particularly in innovation all the time. It is this kind of trap of, well, if I have more data and more anchors, then clearly my risk is lower. But that's not what I hear you saying is that's not going to lower your risk of trying something new, is it?
Not at all. And that is one of the frustrations of working in the data analytics, is that there is sometimes this expectation is that, okay, well, if you just analyze it, then, I can make my decisions with full knowledge. And you can, again, back to, you really have to understand what are my known unknowns, what are my unknown unknowns, and, or, what you obviously don't know what your unknown unknowns are, but you can limit the pool of them, but you can start hypothesizing and guessing, and then that's where the data helps come in. I kind of like to think of it as like if you think of a hand, you put your hand out there and you put a piece of silk over your hand. Underneath it is, it's the full form and shape of your hand, but the silk, you can start to see points, like, okay, well, there's a knuckle sticking up here, a finger sticking up there. You can't see the whole hand. You never will be able to see it clearly, but you can start to get an understanding of the shape and size. Is it a big hand, a little hand? And that's obviously better than assuming it could be something very different. So again, if you think of that shape, it might be a triangle instead of a circle. And by putting that silk over it, you see the form, the shape, you start getting some context around the substance. You'll never see it exactly because you can't, because it's like trying to see inside the atom, so to speak, in some ways. That's right. But you can know more about it than you think you can. And so that's usually what I describe to people. What are you trying to do with analytics? You're not going to get the answer. You're not going to know every single thing about it and again, get rid of all your risk. No longer have to make risk-based decisions. But you can now make those with more knowledge and awareness of what risks you're taking and what unknowns you're dealing with.
So I want to take a second and have you dig in, because I love this idea. I just wrote down known unknowns and unknown unknowns and kind of listing them out. And in some ways, knowing that those buckets exist makes me feel more comfortable taking risks. I don't know why, so maybe you can help me explain that, but that was my initial thought when you said it, was like, oh, well, if I list that out, like, I know that I don't know these things and that I'm going to have to figure, when I try this new initiative or when I shift, you know, to a new market, those things will become obvious to me because that can only happen once I actually put it into action. And then there's a bunch of stuff I don't know, and those are unknown unknowns. But will you just talk a little more about it? Because I think that's an interesting way to capture the things that often hold us back from pushing innovation forward, even when we have some of that data, like you said, in front of us.
Well, yeah, so I think you're picking up on a very important point, which is even if you, like, the unknown, known unknowns, they're still unknown, or you can't know that much about them. And then there's even these ones that, well, how do I list my unknown unknowns? But even by going through the effort of thinking about, well, what would really make, you know, if this happened, what would really, you know, mess up this whole project or this analysis or the answers? And putting those down so that you can look for them in case they do present, themselves or they do show their face. And I like what you said because it makes you feel better, because it's like if you don't, I think everybody knows there's uncertainty, and if you don't try to grasp that uncertainty, to put a face on it, it becomes a monster. It's a boogeyman. You know, you don't know. But once you start really saying, it's kind of like when people think about losing their job. I have mentored people through different career changes, and I've gone through them myself. And everybody's so afraid of, I'm going to lose my job. And I said, well, let's talk about what happens if you lose your job. First of all, you're going to die. You know, we're going to be dead in a month. And no, I'm not going to be dead. Okay, so what's going to happen? Well, I won't be able to pay my rent. Well, how long can you pay? And when you really start people walking them through, well, what's the consequences of a gap, you know, or losing a job and finding another, and realize, well, it's not going to cost me. It's not going to be that costly. I might lose a few months, you know, savings, or I might have to dip into savings. And then you start saying, well, what are the things you might be able to do, you know, given this change, and what's that worth to you? And then they can put it in perspective, and they become a lot more at peace with it, and can take advantage of it. And I personally had that experience myself. And so it's being able to put a face on your fears, and uncertainty is always fearful, and just giving it a face, and that it makes it become. You know, someone nicer. You can give it a smiley face. You become less of a monster.
I really like that, what you're saying, and it really resonates. And there's a couple clients out there that I really hope listen to this and think about with their teams, just going through an exercise of what are our known unknowns and what are our unknown unknowns, just to get the team at ease with, hey, if we try this and it doesn't work the way we hope, we have options. This isn't going to be as hard as we think it is. And we can do a trial run and that'll be okay. And the data, you know, when you're looking at the right data to kind of, to your point, where you're coming from, you're going to be on the right path. And then all these, you know, balls will be lobbed at you, but you've thought about it.
And you can ask the questions, well, how bad can it be? You know, and it's important there. Again, this is where being cognizant of biases and self-fulfilling prophecies. And so really trying to be educated about those, about cognitive science in that regard is important, because you say, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? And you might gloss over some of the worst things, but if you start saying, well, the whole business will collapse, and then some people say, well, is that really true? Well, what would have to happen for the whole business to collapse, for us to go bankrupt? And then you say, we would have to lose 80% of our customers because, you know, the product launch didn't work. It was, how realistic is that? So you can systematically identify the things that your fears and sort of tame them, you know, put them in their box. And then you can start looking for signals that say, okay, well, now, and that, as you were asking earlier, well, what type of, how do you figure out what data you want to collect and monitor? Once you've identified these and, again, put a name to them and put a thought to them, now you can say, well, what metrics can I monitor that will help me know that this scenario might be playing out, you know, or this might be a real risk that we need to address and get at it earlier.
So do you have, we've been talking a lot kind of in theory and high level. Can you walk us through just one, client example of, going from flooded data to, looking at the right metrics to make some smart decisions that actually they were able to monetize?
So one of the projects Andrew and I worked on, it was a lengthy project, and they were working on, and I'm trying to not be too
without sharing confidential information,
right,
of course.
So, but they were, they were looking at how they can drive more value out of their business, primarily on the top line side. And so they have, it's a complex business, a multinational, so they have lots of people all pulling basically the same set of data, whether it's coming from their invoicing system, from an inventory system, from their CRM system. And like most good companies, they were all put together at different times, so they there were a lot of acquisitions. So you might have three different CRM systems going on, two different billing systems, and four different inventory systems, and you're trying to pull these together to get your strategy about, okay, well, how are we going to play in the market? Like if we're launching a new property or a new product or a new site, and so they will have different groups. So your sales group is pulling the same set of data, and this is true, that the sales manager was pulling their data, and they were going through all these same systems, and they had a whole army of people, massaging that data and pulling it to a certain set of metrics and reports. And then you had your sort of revenue management people doing it, and you had product management people doing it, and inventory management people doing it. Each of them had their work streams of pulling this, going back to the same pool and pulling it and coming up with their metrics. And interestingly enough, it's like they all, there's only basic metrics. All business has core metrics. So they're pulling the same ones, but there's a tremendous amount of redundancy. And then, of course, because they're all being pulled differently and put together differently, of course, now you start having variation in these metrics. Well, I say it's this and you say it's that. Sales says it's this. And then by the time it bubbles up to the executive, they don't, there's a lot of frustration. So what we were tasked to do was to pull that information together in a central repository, stitch it together, tie it together, standardize it, work with all the different teams to harmonize the metrics. And then, and as I mentioned, there was a data visualization because there was a lot of very complex metrics. And it is a complex business problem they were attacking. You couldn't get it down to one or two numbers. It really was, a complex set of charts and graphs and measures that they had to think about and comprehend. And they were capable of it. It's just that they all had different ones. So what we did was we pulled all that together in a common tool that runs on an automated process. And now everybody's kind of looking at the same. And we met extensively with all the different stakeholders so that we made sure that we got all the buy-in and that the harmonization of the analytics was going to be accepted and useful. And so then we deployed that through a visualization process, data visualization process, and it's been very well received. And just say, some of the feedback is the amount of time that now the managers spend less time shoveling data and more time actually thinking about it. And whereas before they were going to have to call it four different systems and pull their data, and it would take them half a day before they could actually have anything that they could then start thinking about, well, what does this mean? And by that time they have to go to a meeting. So a lot of that pre-data prep and pre-analytic staging, was just incredibly valuable in freeing them up to analyze and manage and not shovel data around.
You know what? I will tell you what you just said about shoveling versus thinking. I was in Nashville yesterday with clients of mine in the healthcare business, and there was a round table of them. And one of their biggest frustrations was how much time they spent pulling and creating the data, and they don't even get the time to think about it. So they're pulling it, but they're not even, and to me, that really hinders innovation, because that's where the new thinking, the new ideas come from. It's when you have a second to look at the patterns in the bigger picture and say, what does this tell us and what can we do with it? But if you can't even get there, you can't innovate.
Yeah, so really getting hold, and that's where having a decision architecture framework that serves all, can't just one group says, hey, I'm going to put it in, and everybody else, has to use, because each group has their own perspective. So that framework really has to look across the business and across the different perspectives of it, from sales and marketing, from production, from, all the different aspects of the business. And there's a metric or a concept that we use a lot in analytics. We call it time to insight. So when you talk about time to market is critical, of course, in a business context. So the new product development and innovation, getting there. If it takes you 6 months to get there and somebody else gets there three, you've lost them. You've missed the market by the time you get there. time, shortening the time to insight is just as important because as you said, that if it takes you, if it takes the manager 2 days to pull all that information together, and then they, by the time they get there, it's so exhausted, yeah. And they have to go to the meeting, and it's like they can't think anymore. And so, setting up, thinking through your decision architectures, thinking through what are the metrics of the business, and standardizing that flow and automating that flow, so that when it's almost like it's like the taco stand. So you have all, you already have your potato, your tomatoes, you already have your onions, you already have your ground beef, and someone wants to go, I want to get, you know, this taco. Then you just put these pieces together, and then you have your, you know, and different people may want guacamole on it, others may want, you know, something, lettuce or something.
Oh my gosh, Kathy, we are so on the same page. I talk about that in a different way, but the time to insight of, you know, mm-hmm. we spend so much time reporting data, but what we need to be communicating is insights, but we got to get to that phase to even do it. So what you're saying really resonates with innovation, in my opinion, because so for those listening, think about what you're spending your time doing, looking at the numbers and reporting on the number, the data, whatever it is, even if it's qualitative and it's, you know, quotes from customers or whatever, is not the same thing as communicating insights that you can make decisions on.
Exactly. And so what's interesting, I kind of sometimes get perspective, and sometimes I'll read books from the 1800s. Samuel Smiles is one of them. Some of the, when they first started the Industrial Revolution, a lot of these guys were writing about how to do business and, you know, scientific methods in the business. And it's interesting to read them because you realize that when they were talking about how to be more scientific in the business, and they were saying, this book I'm reading now, the author was talking about how to get instinct, gut instinct out of the business. We would say, you know, that was back in the 1800s, and, you know, we're still trying to do that. You know, how to make decisions based on information.
Yeah.
But what's really changed, and I do think we are at a unique point, and we can see it in, you know, our lifestyle, the productivity, just the overall better value of life that we have, that we can enjoy, is we really have started to be able to use information more quickly and wisely. If you think back in the 1800s, you know, managers had to wait for boats and trains to get the results, right?
We would never stand for that.
Then we had to wait for telegrams and telephones, and then you had emails, and now it's tweets, text, and clicks. It's almost like real time. And that is really creating tremendous innovation and tremendous value, and how, you know, when you think about, you know, you want something, you can go, I bought a book last night, I want to read another book. I got on my iPad and downloaded and started reading it.
Yeah.
You know, well, so many years ago, I would have had to wait to go to the store, go find it, and, you know, order it, and, you know, I can get it in seconds, and that's improved my quality of life tremendously. But being able to, the challenge is to, all that data can be worked for good and can really improve it, but you have to be careful you don't get swamped by it.
Yeah, it's so true. Now, speaking of getting things immediately, where can people go to get your book, more information about you and Andrew and what you do?
Our book is on Amazon, so Monetizing Your Data, Amazon.com, and we also have a website, monetizingyourdata.com. And so there we put up some of templates and tools from the book, and some different articles and thought ideas that we've written from that have been generated by the book, and we'll continue to maintain it and try to drive more value in it. Now, I do have to be honest, it's probably not as rich as we wanted to at the moment. Writing the book was a major effort for both of us, and it was something that we tremendously enjoy doing and got so much value. But by the time we get across the finish line, I have to say we're pretty exhausted.
Well, there's a whole other conversation to be had about the marathon that is launching a product of any kind, and I would put a book into that too. So this has been really interesting. My last question for you is, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? So a hobby, passion, experience.
As my name is Kathy Chang, so that does have a Chinese sound to it. And but what's interesting is I grew up in Louisiana, and it was in the early 80s, and I had this chance to just go do a teaching student job in North China in Harbin. And since my geography was so poor, I had no idea how cold it was compared to Louisiana. And so I went from being in 90 degree weather. We were talking earlier about how much I love hot, humid weather. To having to live in minus 31 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, and so what's interesting is I think that when I think about cold, I think about it in centigrade. You ask me, well, how cold is something now? I say, okay, well, that's about zero or that's minus 10. But when I think about hot, it's in, it's 70 degrees, 80 degrees. I don't have a context for hot in centigrade or cold in Fahrenheit. So that's kind of...
I've never heard that before. That is actually fascinating. Well, Kathy, this was incredibly insightful, and I really appreciate, your time, and I think your and Andrew's book is really, it's important to innovation because, as I said in the beginning, I think data can actually set you free to be more innovative if you're looking at the right data. And I think you and I talked about in the beginning, have a little bit of a misconception about data and innovation being at the opposite spectrums, but they're not at all, actually, if you use them well. So thank you for coming on and enlightening us about the power of data.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be able to share this conversation with you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.